Hello and welcome to I'll Look Into It. I'm your host, Tony Yang. Today we're talking about COVID survivors. We're talking to Diana Berendt, who was one of the first people in her area to test positive for COVID-19. While scrambling to get medical information and testing, she became an advocate and activist for herself and others. As a self-described canary in the COVID coal mine, she vowed to amplify her voice as she navigated through the virus odyssey. She documented her illness and recovery through her coronavirus diary, giving the world a glimpse of her struggles and process. While in isolation, Diana launched Survivor Corps, a grassroots or solution-based movement to mobilize the sharply increasing number of people affected by COVID-19 to come together, support, and participate in medical and scientific research community efforts and take a more active role in trying to mitigate this pandemic. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on, Tony.
First of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, I have to tell you. So it has been almost 8 months since I got COVID. I was one of the first, I live right outside of New York City, and I was one of the first people in the New York area to get a confirmed diagnosis of COVID. Not that there weren't others with COVID at the time, but there were very few tests. And so getting a test back in that time, as you know, was exceedingly difficult. And so while I wasn't, one of the only people in New York City at that time who had COVID, I was among the first to get a true documented positive test. And, it was only a week after, I believe, the first person in New York City was diagnosed. And so it was really the time when we knew so little about the virus. I mean, at that point, it's hard to remember. But back in early March, we were still under the sincere impression that this was a virus that was going to affect the elderly and the immunocompromised. It was something that you could protect yourself by washing your hands and not touching your face. No one was wearing masks. Socially distanced wasn't really, a term that had entered our lexicon yet. It was really many lifetimes ago. We have, we're now, in November, and we are now hitting over, 100,000. We hit over 100,000 infections yesterday. We passed Dr. Fauci's predicted marker.
I think that's really scary. And it's also, I think, what the total number of positive COVID cases, about 9 million.
I think it's also worth pointing out that those are the documented cases.
Right.
And so there are many experts who believe that the actual number is a multiple of that. But even if you take that number as gospel, okay, let's just say that it is actually 9 million and not a multiple of it. Even by the CDC's guidance, the CDC's own words and their own metrics, and as we know, the CDC is not exactly liberal with these numbers, they are saying that 1 out of 3 are not recovering. So when you think about that 9 million, when, as a country, we are tracking infections, we are tracking hospitalizations, and we are tracking mortality, but we're assuming under those metrics that of those 9 million, those who aren't dead at the end are recovered, which is not the case. So they're saying, so we're already probably at, over 3 million people who are suffering from long-term COVID in that, out of that 9 million. And that's in the most conservative estimate possible.
So let's talk a little bit about what got you started with Survivor Corps early in the beginning and now what it's kind of morphed into, because I think now that the numbers are so large and so stark, there's got to be huge transformation in your organization, and two, the needs are probably exceeding everybody can kind of support at the moment as well, I would imagine.
Yeah. So what happened was, so I spent 18 days in isolation when I had COVID. At the time, we really didn't know how long you would be contagious for. And I was getting mixed answers, and I was terrified that I could possibly pass it on to anybody else. And so I actually waited until I had a negative test for the virus, which I was probably one of the only people at the time who got a test, not only on the front end of the virus, but on the back end also. And that was because I donated plasma as soon as I was out of isolation. But I spent those 18 days in isolation. And while the world was really taking a tremendous shift around me outside of my locked bedroom, I got sick. I was exposed on March 9th. I, you know, came down with symptoms on Friday, the 13th of March. I know you really can't script it. And, you know, when I came out of isolation in April, I was walked out into a city on fire. You know, it was a very different world. And while I was in isolation, I started to get solicitations that people were forwarding me from Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, which had the first convalescent plasma program going on in the country. And, you know, people were forwarding it to me because I was, you know, I had gone public with the fact that I had COVID and no one else had. So for many people, I was the only person at that point who they knew who had COVID. So I, you know, everyone was forwarding it to me. And I realized that Mount Sinai was not going to be the only show in town for very long, and that there were going to be other convalescent plasma programs that were going to pop up. And I became, you know, fascinated by the history of convalescent plasma. And I started doing research and learning about its application, its development in the 1890s to be used against diphtheria. The Nobel Prize was won for it in 1901. Tony, you're a historian, so I know that you'll appreciate this, my way of, educating myself about it. But I was really blown away by the history of it and its potential use in this novel setting for COVID. And I realized that if I was going to be, unlucky enough to be, no one thinks that they're going to be the first person on their block to get the plague. Especially when you're, 45 and super healthy and you're doing yoga every day, you don't think that you're going to be the first to go down, but that's life. There you go. And we know how contagious it is. And so we know that nobody is immune now, but I realized that if I was going to be unlucky enough to have gotten COVID and, hopefully at that point, lucky enough to have survived, and I was, that there were going to be thousands to follow. And what I didn't realize then is that there were going to be millions to follow that I could not have conceived of. But I realized that if one person had the capacity to come out of this with antibodies, which is almost like having an internal hazmat suit, right? And you can share those antibodies. You can share that natural immunity that your body has built up. You know, my body did exactly what it was supposed to do. It encountered a novel virus. It created the antibodies to fight it off. And it's 8 months later, and I still have some of those antibodies, not as high as I did. Nor should I. They naturally wane over time. But, for those people whose bodies do not mount that same response, having that infusion of somebody else's antibodies can really be the difference between life and death. And while, the efficacy of plasma is still under review and there's still more trials to be done, we've seen that the proof is pudding, and I'm not saying that it's a magic cure, but it is one very important tool in our toolkit. And that if one person had the capacity to come out of this and donate their plasma, knowing that every single donation could save 3 to 4 lives, and, I was able to donate 8 times, imagine what we could do as a coalition of people. And so I started Survivor Corps with the mission of mobilizing an army of survivors to donate their plasma and to support science in every way possible by participating in every trial and study for which it qualified. And I did that, myself. The very first thing I did when I got out of isolation was donate my plasma. I was the first donor actually through Columbia University's convalescent plasma program. I was volunteer number 0001. My plasma, I'm AB positive, which is in the plasma world actually a universal donor. It's different than blood matches before everyone calls in with corrections. And so that's only 4% of the population. And so as my doctor said, my plasma was literally like liquid gold. So my first donation went to research at Columbia, and my 7 subsequent donations all went to patient transfusion. I've also participated in, you know, vaccine research. I've donated blood. I've donated blood for research into neutralizing antibodies, into T-cell research on lasting immunity. You name it, I have participated in a study like that. And, you know, what, and we have really, we were so successful in actually filling up that plasma pipeline that by May, Columbia had a 7,000 or 8,000 person waiting list to donate plasma. There was a 3-month waiting list at the New York Blood Center for people to donate. So we were incredibly successful with that and remain successful with that. But what we started to see in April were that some of our members were not recovering. Mm. And that was startling. And, you know, you mentioned in the introduction about being the canary in the COVID coal mine. Well, what happens is when you're the first one on the block to create a forum for a novel virus, you are the ones who start to see the first patterns. So when you see something once, it's one thing. When you see it 3 times, 5 times, you start to see trends. And that's what we started to see.
What were some of the trends you started to see?
So, I mean, everything from, you know, we saw COVID toes months before it hit the media, hair loss, you know, all kinds of things. The fact that people don't have a fever when they're contagious, and we're able to see those trends and then actually do research to create data to prove it. So, for example, we just closed a 4,000 person study, which is an enormous number in the COVID world. Most of whom were non-hospitalized. And we found that when you take asymptomatic people into account, the percentage of people who have a fever during the time when they're contagious, 4.6%.
That's very interesting.
I mean, it's almost nobody, right? So it means that all those fever scans that we're doing are absolutely useless. It's nothing more than medical theater. But we're able to see these patterns and then we're able to prove it through the data. And so we're, one of our goals is to try to close that gap between policy and science.
I mean, that's the one unique aspect of this virus. It affects so many systems. You know, I'll talk to friends who are physicians, you know, and we'll kind of say, much like you being AB positive for as a universal donor, this is almost a universal virus, right? Because it affects so many systems within.
Right. I mean, exactly. So that goes back to this sort of difference between what we thought this virus was and what this virus actually is. You know, going back to early March when I got infected, we thought that this was a respiratory disease. Even when when I was sick, I ended up with terrible GI issues by the, you know, about 10 days in, maybe a week in. I'd have to go back and look to see exactly, but maybe about a week in, I started to get terrible GI issues. And I actually thought that I had food poisoning or a stomach virus on top of COVID because there was literally nothing about GI issues and COVID. I had to get to page 10 of Google Scholar to find one report from Wuhan that said, you know, reported 4 people having had diarrhea. When now we know that GI issues can be one of the most common presenting signs of COVID, and it can be one of the most long-lasting issues with COVID as well. And, you know, going back to those sort of early misconceptions in thinking that this was purely a respiratory disease, you know, we now really understand that it is a vascular disease. And while it might start in the lungs, it affects the vasculature, which means that, look, there is not a single organ system in our body that is not dependent on blood supply. So once you have something that affects all of the blood supply to your to all of your body, you're going to have problems. And so we are seeing people with clotting issues, with microclotting issues, with lack of blood supply. We're seeing people with brain damage, literal brain damage, people in their 30s, people in their 20s who are having heart attacks and strokes months after having COVID. I was diagnosed with COVID onset glaucoma a couple of months ago, and further scans of my eyes revealed fraying of the capillaries and darkening in the eyes. I mean, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. But you know, the ophthalmologist was, you know, he is, and he was able to say, like, see these dark areas. These are microclots in your eyes, which is consistent with COVID. And so it's startling, and it should frighten everybody to know just how sinister this virus is, because, you know, talk about it not being the same as the flu. You know, we are, the number of people who we are seeing who are coming out of this with, you know, COVID onset, fill in the blank, COVID onset diabetes, COVID onset lupus. I mean, really serious stuff.
I'd like to remind you that you're listening to I'll Look Into It. We're talking with Diana Berendt, who was one of the first people in her area to test positive for COVID-19 and the founder of Survivor Corps for COVID long haulers. You know, since this virus affects so many systems, I mean, it probably runs the gamut, but can you tell us a little bit about what COVID long haulers are suffering from? I mean, just the variety of would be good to kind of know about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, when the CDC, they changed their symptom list from 4 symptoms to 12 at the end of July. At the same time, we put out a list of 98 symptoms. I think that if we were to do that survey again, you know, 3 months later, I think that we would have at least double that number. So we are seeing everything, as I said, from diabetes and lupus and autoimmune issues to, you know, obviously cardiac issues, you know, obviously pulmonary issues, but we are also seeing hearing loss. We are seeing severe neurological issues, really, really painful conditions, arthritic issues, peripheral neuropathy. I have had lingering headaches and deep inner ear pain. I had such severe headaches while I had acute COVID. And remember, let me be perfectly clear about this. I had a very average case of COVID. I never came close to being hospitalized. I never needed oxygen. I had a very, very typical, what I call Tylenol and Gatorade type of COVID. Do not think of my experience and think of me in a hospital or on a ventilator or anything else. Literally, I took Tylenol and Gatorade and never left my bedroom. I had the experience that most people with COVID have. And, you know, it is really, like, I had terrible lower back pain when I had, and that was my kidneys that I was feeling. I mean, thankfully I didn't have any damage to my kidneys, but I had such excruciating headaches that I actually texted a friend of mine who's a doctor at the time and said, is it possible that I have encephalitis? Because I felt like my brain was literally going to explode out of my skull. And I'm now seeing articles saying that there is some sort of encephalitis that can happen. And that's what explains these headaches and the deep inner ear pain and all of these things that I'm still experiencing 8 months later, because there's still swelling in my head that is almost reminiscent of a severe concussion. But again, I've had it extremely easy. I have not had the neurological impacts. You know, professional people who can't go back to work, forget about the physical issues that they don't have the energy to do it, that they can't get out of bed, but that they can't remember words, or they have to have whiteboards around their house all of a sudden to remind them of simple tasks. We have members who are, you know, repeatedly leaving their, you know, wallets in the refrigerator and, you know, the ice cream in the closet and so on and so forth. And it sounds funny, but it's really not. It's not funny at all when you think about people who are at the prime of their life and are not, you know, from having had a not so simple virus, but not being able to go back to work after that and suffering these long tail effects that are ravaging. And, you know, just really, it is really sobering to see what people are going through. And, you know, when we talked about the CDC numbers before, it's important to point out that in their calculations, they say one in five people who are not recovering are young, healthy people with no pre-existing conditions. And Tony, when I say young, the CDC defines young as 18 to 34. I'm not in that category. you know, it's 18 to 34. That's young. You know, I'm healthy, but yeah. I'm now 46. I'm not in that category. I'm the one in three.
And part of the reason, you know, I wanted to do this interview was, you know, we have the Young Invincibles around where we broadcast out of KUCR. And, you know, this is a good public service reminder, you know, just because you're probably not going to die from this doesn't mean that there's not going to be some long-term effects on it.
And you might die.
Yeah,
We don't know, yeah. Because that's just as random too. I mean, this is literally like, you have no idea what you're going to get with this. It's like reaching into a shopping bag and just, I mean, it's playing the lottery. And the odds are not in your favor.
Right, so you're not in control.
You are absolutely not in control. And like, you know, there are a lot of things that you can say, oh, okay, that's fine. You know, if I get this, I'm in good shape, I'll beat it, I'll be fine. You know, this one, you have absolutely no control over. You have no idea which category you are going to end up in. And if you're thinking about this as a binary between, you know, okay, I'll get the flu, I'll be sick for a few days, but then I'll have it behind me. It'll be great, you know, then I don't have to worry about it. And on the other hand, ending up on a ventilator, but sure, that's not going to be me because I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm invincible. What do you mean? No, that's not how it works. There's a huge, huge bucket in between those choices where a good portion of people end up. And I assure you, you do not want to end up there. And when we're talking about people not recovering, we're talking about only the people who are consistently sick. So we also have so many members, and I count myself among this category of people who feel better after a few weeks. I had a couple of months where I felt pretty good. I you know, I was up to walking 10 miles a day. I had gained back the weight that I had lost while I had COVID. And then over the summer, I was so sick all over again. I had like 2 months where I was so symptomatic that I actually went to urgent care at one point for anti-nausea medication. I've only been nauseated twice before in my life, and that was when I was pregnant with each of my kids. And I had such severe nausea, I went to urgent care to get medication, and they insisted on giving me a diagnostic COVID test because I presented as being so symptomatic. And again, that was months after an average case, and we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be. So even if you're in the category of people who get over it after 2 weeks and you feel fine afterwards, we don't know that you're fine because we are seeing lasting heart damage and lasting lung damage from even asymptomatic cases. So we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be on anyone's bodies, adults, teenagers, young people, or our children.
Yeah. And that's one of the that's one of my biggest fears. You know, we had talked a little bit before we started recording here, you know, as a Civil War historian, or at least a late 19th century historian, one of the things I've studied was Civil War pensioners. The fact that these men were injured in their 20s, we were paying for them for the rest of their lives as part of these sort of economic costs. You know, there are going to be such stark long-term economic costs just from the damage that's being done with COVID. And so when I hear people sort of say, let's open up the economy, the economic damage is terrible. The economic damage from people surviving this is going to be absolutely horrific moving forward, because we're going to have to care for it as a society one way or another. And so, you know, those are some of my long-term concerns. You know, what are some of yours? Because I think this is moving forward. Everybody's in a different age bucket. We have the 20-somethings. We have people in their mid-career in their 40s. And then we have people who are senior citizens. You know, what are some of the concerns that you kind of see, in, especially amongst the survivors, and what your organization wants to start advocating for?
I can't thank you enough, Tony, for putting it in those terms, because you're absolutely right. And while I don't think that we should be looking at a health crisis in purely economic terms, I think that it negates the argument that we need to reopen because of the economy. And I think that it is such an important point, because the cost of surviving COVID but not recovering is enormous. For every single person who survives COVID, you're talking about MRIs and doctor's appointments and CAT scans and possible lifetime on medications for, you know, complications from COVID that could, you know, cripple this economy. Forget about the actual cost of all of those things, the insurance costs, the cost to the medical system, the fact that we are already in dealing with a medical system where we have so many people who live in areas that are underserved. It is really highlights the disparity and equity issues in medicine and healthcare. If you take out all of those vital issues, and you think about just the labor, the people who you're taking out of the workforce, because, you know, the people who are really suffering from long-term COVID are people like me, or people in their 30s, people in their 20s, people who are at the prime of their lives. We are not talking about an elderly population. Elderly population, when they get COVID, they either survive or they don't, more likely than ending up in this sort of liminal state where, you know, you're not better and you don't have necessarily active COVID anymore, which is why we need protections set up for everybody who has been infected. And that is whether or not they were able to secure a diagnostic test when they weren't available and often faulty. So we at Survivor Corps are advocating, we are pushing for we need long-term COVID care centers throughout the country so that people can get the care that they need. You know, if you had COVID and it's been more than 3 weeks and you're not feeling back to yourself or you're having strange things happen, you know, in all likelihood, it is not in your head. You're not going crazy. And if a lot of people are going to their doctors with these sorts of complaints, but it's outside of their doctor's experience and wheelhouse, and they haven't seen this before. And the first inclination is to say, oh, you're stressed, you're anxious, it's the middle of a pandemic, you know, just bide your time, or I'll give you some anti-anxiety medication. And yes, of course, everybody is anxious and everybody is depressed and we are in the middle of the pandemic, and all those things very well might be true, but you need medical help because you might also be, you know, experiencing tachycardia or, you know, some other cardiac issue, which is making your heart race, and it's not necessarily just anxiety. So it's a message that you need help. And it's one thing to say you need help and then not provide that help. Where are people supposed to go? Where are people supposed to turn? There are very few long-term COVID care centers in the country right now, and we need them everywhere. We don't even have a name for this right now. You know, the NIH is calling it post-COVID syndrome, but an article just came out yesterday saying that it's very possible that the virus is remaining active for much longer than we thought in some people. And so I've been saying from the beginning, we can't call it post-COVID because we don't know enough about this virus to know that it's post anything. So, you know, And to call some, and at the same time, also, when you add in the words post or syndrome, I would say that I think it's fair to say that our recent medical history has not treated those issues kindly. So, you know, I go with long-term COVID. The rest of the world is using long COVID. That's what the World Health Organization is using. And long COVID, I think, you know, it works. It just doesn't sound quite right in American English. I actually had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Fauci about this last week, and he agreed. He liked long-term COVID. He said he would take it under consideration. So, you know, but having a name is incredibly important. You know, to quote T.S. Eliot, the naming of a disease is a delicate matter. So it needs a name, because unless you have a name, you can't get a billing code. You can't, and you know, if you don't have a billing code, how do you get coverage? How do you get research? We need a parallel Operation Warp Speed race for a therapeutic that will, we need more tools in our toolkit. We need something to give people when they are diagnosed with COVID that will keep it from progressing, you know, and then we need also something to be able to give people who have already suffered the ravages of the virus to help them heal in a systemic way, as opposed to just, you know, shuttling them off to a whole bunch of different specialists who aren't really looking at it from a COVID lens. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. And with the number of people who are getting diagnosed every single day, our job is becoming more and more difficult as time marches on. We have no time to waste. It, you know, the fact that it's November, we still don't have a national COVID strategy.
Well, that's a topic for a different time. I'm afraid we're all out of time. We've been talking. That could take us some time. We've been talking to Diana Berendt, who was one of the first people in her area to test positive for COVID-19. While in isolation, Diana launched Survivor Corps, a grassroots solution-based movement to mobilize the sharply increasing number of people affected by COVID-19 to come together, support, and participate in the medical and scientific research community efforts and take a more active role in trying to mitigate this pandemic. Thanks, as usual, to our engineer, Elia Fong, our producer, Clark Price. Thank you for listening.